time, she has been treated different and apart from already specially treated convicts of very serious crimes. Maxwell had exhausted all her remedies to seek a new trial. Her final attempt was to petition the Supreme Court of the United States with a writ certiorari, which is a writ that people use as a last resort to get their case heard. It's the final court. And she had this petition in the Supreme Court, and about 2 months ago, that petition was denied. And so now her only avenue to be released from jail is either a pardon or a commutation by the president. Well, a pardon frees the individual being pardoned from any stain of the crime. A commutation is simply a release. The person is released immediately, but all of the negatives of a conviction apply to this person, such as potential parole or inability to have certain freedoms that non-convicts have.
On that note, Bill Maestas, attorney at law, I want to thank you very much for joining us on Politics or Pedagogy.
Okay.
This is John Crumshaw with a special Politics or Pedagogy education report.
You're listening to KPFK, 90.7 FM Los Angeles. The time now is 1 p.m.
Good afternoon and welcome to Middle East in Focus. I'm Esty Chandler. Never again is a phrase widely associated with the lessons of the Nazi Holocaust and subsequent genocides. In the early years following World War I, Nie wieder Krieg, never again war, had become a central slogan of mass anti-war rallies in the Weimar Republic. As Ben Ratzkoff wrote as a guest contributor at the LA Times in September, over the years, the phrase never again has, quote, emerged in many contexts, end quote. It was used by a multinational community of Buchenwald concentration camp prisoners liberated in 1945 to denounce fascism and was later popularized by infamous American-born Israeli Orthodox rabbi, writer, and controversial ultra-nationalist politician Meir Kahana in his 1971 book, Never Again. Kahana founded the Jewish Defense League, or JDL, in the United States, which was classified as a right-wing terrorist group by the FBI in 2001, and founded the far-right Kach Party in Israel. Ratzkoff describes the events that sparked his September 10th op-ed this way, quote, on September 4th, the Holocaust Museum, LA, posted a now-deleted Instagram carousel with a seemingly banal message, quote, Jews were raised to say never again. That means never again for anyone, end quote. An accompanying graphic depicted six interlocked arms of different skin tones, the lightest one tattooed in the style of Auschwitz prisoners. Additional slides added, Jews must not let the trauma of our past silence our conscience, and to be Jewish is to remember and act. With us today to discuss those events, his op-ed, and the title the LA Times put on his piece, When Did Never Again Become a Controversial Statement, is the aforementioned Ben Ratzkoff. Ben Ratzkoff is an associate professor in the Department of Critical Theory and Social Justice at Occidental College. His teaching and research focus on the relationship between anti-Semitism, white supremacy, and colonialism, and the politics of Holocaust memory and representation. He has been published in a number of academic journals, edited volumes, and in public media, including the LA Times, the Los Angeles Review of Books, and Jewish Current. It is my pleasure to welcome Ben Ratzkoff to Middle East in Focus.
Thank you very much. It's wonderful to be here. Just a tiny correction is I'm an assistant professor at Occidental College. I don't know if I maybe miswrote that.
You read it correctly. I was giving you a promotion.
Thank you. I'll take it.
So, Ben, in discussing the use of the phrase never again by Buchenwald concentration camp prisoners liberated in April of 1945, you provide a probable cause of it soon becoming a controversial statement when used differently in September 1945 by Abba Kovner. Could you talk about the two different uses of it by Jews in post-World War II Europe that you wrote about?
Yeah, so I mean, I'll start by actually expanding a little bit by saying that it actually wasn't Jews, right? I mean, I think that part of one of the difficulties with a lot of Holocaust education and commemoration today is the way it focuses on Jewish victims in a kind of exclusive frame, which is just not at all how most of World War II unfolded, right? I mean, there were kind of all sorts of groups, often in chaotic, mixed up situations, certainly in the camps, right? And so what's actually so interesting is how, you know, despite the fact that the phrase is associated with Jews today and it's become a kind of slogan, certainly taken up by Jewish institutions, etc., the first sort of articulation of it that we know of was by political prisoners in Buchenwald, which is to say, for the most part, I mean, they very well could have been Jews, but for the most part, we're talking about non-Jewish political prisoners. And specifically in Buchenwald, you had something called the International Camp Committee, which was formed by a German communist prisoner that was a kind of underground resistance. And Buchenwald is somewhat famous for, you know, at its liberation by an infantry division of the U.S. Army, inmates, prisoners in Buchenwald itself sort of preemptively took up arms from within the camp and forced the SS officers to sort of flee. And so you had this kind of very organized group of surviving prisoners who then, after the liberation, they actually created their own memorial ceremony in April of 1945. So this really interesting sort of very early kind of grassroots memory work that's happening. And it is at this ceremony that they basically read aloud what was called the Oath of Buchenwald. And they also drew up these sorts of drafting documents of the Manifesto of the Democratic Socialists of the former Buchenwald concentration camp. So that is, in many ways, what is understood as perhaps the earliest post-Holocaust origin story for the phrase never again. And by the way, at the event, part of the commemoration that they did, reportedly from what we know, is that they were holding signs that said never again. And they made a speech or kind of the oath that said, you know, we won't stop fighting until the last perpetrator is brought to justice. And we want to build a new world of peace and freedom or something like that. So anyway, it was this, you know, very political, anti-fascist sort of slogan, you could say. Now, by September of 1945 is when you start having really Abba Kovner start articulating really vocally this kind of vengeful form of Jewish Holocaust memory itself. And he says then, and I'm not really sure what the exact source, but from what I've read, you know, something like never again will Jews be murdered, right? And so from the very beginning, you could say there is this kind of split. And again, it's not just a split that's internal to the Jewish community or even the community of Jewish survivors, right? But in general, I would say survivors of Nazism in general, right, were sort of split, you could say, about what the meaning of this emerging phrase might be in the context of post-World War II.
Right. Thank you so much for all of that. Moving on to the controversy around the Holocaust Museum LA's deleted Instagram post, which I would argue had been smoldering for about 2 years. I wonder if you can begin by talking about the social media responses to the Holocaust Museum LA IG post, which you described in your piece as apoplectic.
Yes, I would be happy to. I mean, It's funny because partly I think some of it is, you know, is just sort of the tone of social media, right? That you could say in some ways turns things up a notch. But it was kind of just amazing. I mean, you know, I saw this post that I understood to be like just a sort of very mainstream, typical sentiment, right? At least since the 1990s, this sort of, you know, universalist approach to Holocaust memory, at least at the official institutional museum level, is something that was not even just mainstream, foundational. I mean, this was literally the sentiment that was at the foundation of institutionalizing Holocaust memory in the 1990s and onward. And so, you know, you see this post and I just sort of think, yeah, that's kind of the slogan. But I also wasn't naive. I mean, I knew that, as you mentioned, right, this sort of tension was brewing, you could say, since Israel's assault on Gaza after October 7th, almost immediately, which was immediately justified, right, as a kind of war against, quote, new Nazis, unquote. And so from that moment on, at the very least, you could see this tension, although really the tension had been brewing, I would say, basically really since like 2016 and after the IHRA, the International Holocaust Remembrance Alliance, really pivoted from Holocaust memorialization to anti-Semitism advocacy. You know, you start to get a sense of some of this tension between the universalist and particularist sentiments brewing. But in any case, we get this post and, you know, the comments, I mean, I think it was just kind of incredible. I just thought there's comments, there's reposts, you know, where they're adding their text over it and commenting. And what I found to be somewhat of a consistent response that was somewhat jarring to me was this kind of possessiveness, this insistence that this phrase is, quote, ours, unquote, right? That it belongs to the Jewish people. And a real kind of insisting on that, this sort of proprietary relationship to never again. And you saw it across the spectrum, right? There's sorts of these, you know, they call themselves progressives. I don't know actually necessarily their politics, but people from across the spectrum, sort of right-wing pro-Israel influencers to sort of self-identified progressives who had this sort of insistence that there was some kind of ownership relationship between Jews and this phrase. And the feeling like this post was therefore, again, it was not even just, oh, you're inaccurate, or, oh, that's not what it means. It was experienced as a loss of property, Jewish property. And that was just kind of amazing to me. And some of it certainly is related to pro-Israel advocacy politics around that. But a lot of it I found just is kind of the language of identitarian grievance that has become mainstream in maybe the past decade, that now Jewish influencers were really kind of replicating, right? This belongs to us. We get to use this phrase. We get to define when it's used. And to suggest anything else, right, is experienced as an injury to my identity.
Right. I would say that the IHRA at their pivot was that they pivoted from Holocaust memorialism to getting involved with the conflation of anti-Semitism and anti-Zionism. But I want to say that we are so happy to be joined today by Ben Ratzkoff. You're listening to Middle East in Focus on listener-supported KPFK in Los Angeles. We're discussing with assistant professor in the Department of Critical Theory and Social Justice at Occidental College and guest contributor at the LA Times of when did never again become a controversial statement, Ben Ratzkoff. So, Ben, to continue, as you wrote, within 2 days, the museum capitulated. I'm quoting you, apologizing for posting an item using language including easily open to misinterpretation and a political statement reflecting the ongoing situation in the Middle East. So I wonder if you can talk about your conclusion about the museum's apology, which was, quote, "The implication behind such a euphemism was that the 'never again for anyone' message might have encouraged reflection on the violence currently inflicted by the Israeli state on the people of Gaza."
Yeah. I mean, first of all, I think I want to mention that as far as I can tell, the apology has also now been removed. And so just this morning in preparation for this interview, I went to kind of just see what was going on the Holocaust Museum LA's Instagram. And it seems like not only was the apology removed, but there is not a single post after September 3rd. Okay, so I just want to note that this entire debacle basically has led to what seems like a just shutting down of social media, right? It's sort of like you either toe the Zionist line or you don't say anything at all is kind of what I'm getting from that. But anyway, they did at first post this apology where they said, you know, "We're so sorry. It's easily open to misinterpretation. And, you know, and we in no way, right, intended that it would be directly reflecting on," and this is what they say. I mean, just an incredible, I almost would call it, I said euphemism. I mean, I would just say it's a denialist statement, right? The ongoing situation in the Middle East. So what they're suggesting, right, what they're responding to, of course, is the fact that that is how so much of the commentary on social media, the comments, literally the comments, right, as well as the reposts, were framed. And this is coming, of course, in after almost 2 years of many pro-Palestinian influencers and allies also invoking Holocaust memory to understand and analyze and raise awareness around the genocide in Gaza. And so that's sort of the subtext that everyone was kind of reading into, you could say, right, the post. Now, I just want to be clear. Like, I mean, I really don't think that's what the post was about, because knowing the museum and where they're situated in the Jewish community, right, like, I just don't think that that is actually what they were trying to imply. I mean, they were just, again, probably on sort of marketing autopilot and just kind of recycling the phrases that are used in Holocaust memorialization. But in any case, what they did by apologizing, right, was that they basically contributed to this kind of what has been going on, as I suggested, the last 10 years, but has accelerated in the last, you know, 2-3 years of this, you know, what Israeli historian Amos Goldberg calls the erosion of the universalist basis of Holocaust memory, right? By suggesting that they would never suggest that we could actually draw on the history and lessons and memories of the Holocaust to understand the war of annihilation and the genocidal violence in Gaza, is basically turning away from this kind of universalist or cosmopolitan basis that really was the basis of hegemonic Holocaust memory. And so that's what I think was just really significant, you know, for me. The fact that there's this tension, that's always been there. But what we see is that an institution like Holocaust Museum LA basically capitulating and carving out this Palestine exception in its memory politics, right, was just a sign of this furthering turn away from that universalism.
Yeah, and really sad for me, because I've long been advocating that Holocaust Museum LA should be the place where students are taken to learn about the Holocaust, not the Museum of quote unquote tolerance, which is often quite intolerant, that has this ginormous contract with LAUSD, but I digress. So,
I mean, I agree with you. I mean, I would say that there's a lot to say. I, at the college level, I would take my students to the Museum of Tolerance as an object of study. But I think I just do want to say the Holocaust Museum LA, the tragedy of this is that the Holocaust Museum LA was such a unique institution in the landscape of Holocaust memory in the United States. It is very survivor driven, community driven institution, unlike the sort of, you know, what we think of as big Holocaust, right? Like the USHMM, the Museum of Tolerance, the Shoah Foundation, right? These sort of massive institutions that are entangled also with the state I mean, the USHMM is a federal right institution. And so this sort of Holocaust memory from below, this kind of actually survivor-driven, connected to the survivor community in LA, I think when it started, it was like a room on the fourth floor of the Federation Building or something, right? And as a kind of archive for the objects that survivors in LA had from Europe. And so for many reasons, it was just a really kind of special place. And it didn't have a lot of the theatrics, the highly immersive theatrics of the Museum of Tolerance or the USHMM. But something that is happening, and it's not just with this episode. I mean, it's also with this massive, massive expansion they're doing. The museum's closed until, I think, the summer right now because of this expansion, where, you know, I'm concerned about the museum becoming more and more a part of this kind of big Holocaust museum template and losing some of its local identity.
Perhaps the curtain has been pulled back. So to my mind, more importantly, as you wrote, I believe in both response to the post and the apology for it, you wrote, quote, "It reflects a deeper turn away from the universalist approach that has been at the heart of institutional Holocaust memory culture since the 1990s. Can you take a few minutes to discuss some of that history first, Ben?
Yes, absolutely. So, as I think I've mentioned briefly here, basically, often, and especially people my age who were raised or who went to public schools in the 90s and on and after, where Holocaust education was a part of our like public school education and curriculum. And when I was in eighth grade, my public school, we went on a trip to DC and we go to the US Holocaust Memorial Museum. There was a sense of it's always been like this, right? Like there was a kind of a faulty assumption that we were in the fourth, fifth decade of Holocaust education, when in fact, that's not the case at all, right? That this is something that really emerged relatively recently at the institutional level. And so typically what is seen as kind of the decades where this happens is basically between the mid-80s until 2005. And you have in that period, I mean, if you want, you can go back to the Holocaust miniseries in the late 70s, which really transforms awareness of the Holocaust through American television. But it's especially in the late 80s and the early 90s that we start to see these international, large-scale investments in Holocaust commemoration and education. I mean, so 1985, for example, just to mark it, is the year that Shoah comes out. Claude Lanzmann's documentary Shoah, which is just a significant cinematic event. But especially in 1993, which is sometimes called the year of the Holocaust, is when the USHMM in DC opens, Schindler's List is released as well, right? That same year. And then subsequently the Shoah Foundation, the USC, well, now the USC Shoah Foundation, but at the time the Shoah Foundation opens, then what becomes the IHRA, what starts as the International Task Force on Holocaust Education, Remembrance, and Research, I think, is in the late 90s, 1998. And then you get the Stockholm Declaration, which would become the actual IHRA founding document in 2000. And all of this culminates basically with the opening of the Memorial to the Murdered Jews of Europe in Berlin in 2005, which is the same year that Yad Vashem opens in Israel. So anyway, you could just see that in this sort of two decades is this kind of expansive period when Holocaust memory, again, is not emerging. Obviously, survivors were in existence before, but is becoming institutionalized and is getting this, you know, especially at the international level or the level of the European Union. Much of this had to do with the end of the Cold War, the reunification of Germany, the rise of the EU, and this sort of search for identity. What is our identity in this new Europe, in this new Germany? And one of the things the identity is kind of built around is Holocaust commemoration. I mean, in Germany especially, right, is where they decide to create this new Germany that is going to be premised on atonement for the past. And that begins, and within that sentiment that becomes out of the 1990s, and much of this I'm drawing on the work of Amos Goldberg, who I'd mentioned before, but is that there is this tension, right, between this universalist basis of never again for anyone, stopping genocides everywhere, concern about human rights violations. And then on the other hand, you have this special concern around anti-Semitism, around Jews, and that is often, you know, never again anti-Semitism. And that's translated oftentimes into support or even just empathy for the state of Israel.
Perhaps the most important point, you point out the irony that many of those online commenters who attacked the museum's post likely self-identify as liberals or even progressives, who would, as you write, quote, would likely be unsettled to discover how closely their identitarian rejection of the universalism mirrors the current Israeli government's public diplomacy, increasingly targeted at Jews who deviate from its ethno-nationalist agenda, end quote. Can you talk in our last few minutes about the broad representation of that reality?
Yes. So thank you. So I think part of what was deeply unsettling was seeing these figures who, I mean, they're not even necessarily people that I always agree with myself, but they are figures who do identify themselves as certainly liberals and many of them progressives, you know, and they're sort of these Jewish influencer figures on social media. And, you know, in the comments, they just themselves were kind of saying, this is all lives matter, right? This kind of petty, spiteful appropriation of debates around Black Lives Matter and saying that this slogan is meant just to honor Jews. I mean, they're just making things up out of thin air. They don't know anything about the history. And of course, what they're saying, this proprietary, right, this is meant for us, this is ours, was something that we saw the Israeli foreign ministry explicitly saying when they, for example, they pressured the Buchenwald Memorial to cancel Omri Baum's speech. And they said, we don't want this universalist approach at all. And so I think I was just struck by the ways that even in some of our own conversations, perhaps among progressives, we can also reproduce some of these identitarian possessive logics around, you know, our history and what is ours and what we own. And we should be especially cautious around that, especially in this scenario where it's functioning to advance this kind of repressive and reactionary agenda.
Well, you certainly caught my attention, and I'm grateful that you wrote the piece. From remarks by President Obama at the Holocaust Days of Remembrance ceremony on April 23rd, 2009, about the 89th Infantry Division, the first Americans to reach a Nazi concentration camp, they actually liberated Ohrdruf, part of Buchenwald, where tens of thousands had perished. I quote, the story goes that when the Americans marched in, they discovered the starving survivors and the piles of dead bodies. And General Eisenhower made a decision. He ordered Germans from the nearby town to tour the camp so they could see what had been done in their name. And he ordered American troops to tour the camp so they could see the evil they were fighting against. Then he invited congressmen and journalists to bear witness. And he ordered that photographs and films be made. Some of us have seen those same images, whether in the Holocaust Museum or when I visited Yad Vashem. And they never leave you. Eisenhower said that he wanted, quote, to be in a position to give firsthand evidence of these things if ever in the future there develops a tendency to charge these allegations merely to propaganda, end quote. Eisenhower understood the danger of silence. He understood that if no one knew what had happened, that would be yet another atrocity, and it would be the perpetrator's ultimate triumph, end quote. We at Middle East in Focus and KPFK also believe in bearing witness to the genocides that continue today. Once again, I want to thank our wonderful guest, Ben Ratzkopf, assistant professor in the Department of Critical Theory and Social Justice at Occidental College. I also want to thank Mark Maxwell for his production support today. Our theme song is The Overture from Summer Night's Dream by Marcel Khalife. For KPFK Los Angeles, I'm Esti Chandler, thanking you for your continued support of KPFK and for taking this time to put the Middle East in focus.